The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, David Grimm, editor for our daily news site, Science Now, is here to talk about some recent stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. So first up, Dave, we have a story on the social fabric of elephant herds. For anyone who's seen the Disney movie Dumbo, it may come as no surprise that elephants feel sad sometimes, but it has yet to be scientifically quantified.
Well, Sarah, it is a good question, you know, what emotions other animals feel. This study isn't so much about whether elephants feel sad, but more about what sort of impact traumatic events have on elephants that witness these events early in their lives.
So this is actually about a practice called culling. What is culling and why would we do it?
Well, culling has been used in South Africa from about the 1960s to the 1990s. And basically what it is, it is a tool to thin elephant herds. And the reason you'd want to do that is because when there's too many elephants on a piece of land, they can be very destructive to the habitat, especially if they're in a fenced reserve. And so what wildlife managers would do is they would get in a helicopter, which would herd an elephant family into a tight bunch. And then hunters would shoot as many of the animals as possible, as quickly as possible, leaving only the young elephants, elephants from about 4 to 10 years of age, alive. And then these young elephants would be shipped to other parks that didn't have as many elephants. And researchers have known for a while that this isn't good for the young elephants. They seem to suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder. Elephants that have grown up with such trauma tend to be a lot more aggressive. They kill rhinoceroses. They attack tourist vehicles. But nobody's really looked at how this sort of impacts more fundamental aspects of these animals' lives. Social learning is really important for elephants. And the question has been, does this early life trauma impact their social learning?
Right. So how did they end up looking at this in more detail?
Well, Sarah, they compared two populations of elephants. One was from Kenya's Amboseli National Park. And the elephants here really haven't been through a whole lot of trauma in their lives. And they compared them to elephants that grew up on the Pilanesberg Reserve. And these elephants, a lot of them were exposed to this early culling trauma. And then what they did was they played a few calls from other elephants. And they manipulated these calls so they would sound like they came from a dominant, strange female. And strange means a female that neither group knew. And usually when elephants hear this call, they get really cautious because calls from these dominant, stranger females can indicate that maybe a female is approaching that can pose a danger to the family. And here's what one of those calls sounds like. And when they played this call for the Amboseli elephants, the elephants that really hadn't been exposed to trauma early in their lives, the elephants acted appropriately. They froze, they bunched together, and sometimes they even charged towards where the sound was coming from, maybe in an attempt to scare off this intruding female. But the Pilanesberg elephants, the ones that had been exposed to trauma early in life, didn't react appropriately at all. In fact, their reactions were really random. Sometimes they left the area. Sometimes they didn't do anything at all. They just sort of sat there relaxed. And this indicates that these elephants really aren't sharing this social knowledge. It's so important for not only their survival, but really understanding how to react to other elephants in their midst.
Why do they think that this is due to the culling trauma?
Well, when these young elephants are relocated to new reserves, they form family units again. So that indicates that it's not the fact that they haven't interacted with adults in their lives. It's that maybe they're not able to learn for some reason from these interactions. There's something that's become very messed up about them, that they're just not able to engage socially or learn socially like they usually do.
And so what does it mean when an elephant doesn't know how to behave socially? What are the consequences?
Well, one of the big consequences is it can actually interfere with their reproductive success. You can imagine if you don't really understand the signals of another elephant, you're not going to be able to mate with that elephant, and you're not going to be able to sire offspring. So even though these young elephants were spared early in their lives from culling, they may actually have a very bleak future.
Next up, we have a story on newborn infections. Babies are particularly prone to cold, flu, infections in general. But the question is, why are their immune systems so weak at that time in their lives?
Right. It's been a really big question. Obviously, it's a very important question because actually newborns are much more likely to die than older babies of these types of infections. And for some reason, having a weak immune system at birth must serve some sort of important function. And scientists have had a few hypotheses. They've thought, well, maybe just like everything else, when a newborn is born, you know, not everything is fully developed yet, and the immune system might just be one of those things. You know, it's just not as developed as it will be later on. The other idea has been that because the baby spends so much time in the mother's uterus, that it must suppress its immune system, otherwise it will reject the mother. And also the mother may do the same thing. She suppresses her immune system so she doesn't reject the baby. But this new study actually has a different conclusion.
So what's the third option?
Well, the third option, according to this new research, is that infants may actually suppress their immune system because they are trying to build up this, what scientists call, microbiome in their guts. And this is the population of bacteria that's been shown to be really important for everything from our weight to our metabolism to even things like arthritis and potentially even behavior.
So how do they figure out that the third option might be the right one?
They did all these experiments in mice. And the first thing they did was they gave strong immune cells, they injected them into newborn mice, and they found that these immune cells just kind of turned off in the newborn mice. But when they did the opposite, they took the newborn mice's immune cells and placed them into adults, those cells which had been dormant turned on. So they figured there must be something going on in the body of the newborns that's shutting their immune system down, or at least really muting it. When they looked a little bit closer, they found that there was this particular class of immune cells that eventually develop into red blood cells. They express a surface receptor called CD71, which causes the immune suppression of other cells. When they knocked out the cells, they found that young mice started to get a lot of inflammation in their intestines. But as the mice grew older, there were fewer and fewer cells that had these CD71 receptors, suggesting that the mice were somehow, over time, ramping up their immune system or activating their immune system, but that very early on, they were deactivating it. And the researchers take all this together, and they basically think what's happening is that this is something that's done on purpose. As the mice are developing this gut microbiome, they don't want to be killing off all the bacteria that are growing in their guts, which is what the immune system would do. And so they have to keep their immune system suppressed early on, and they only wrap it up later once that microbiome has fully established itself.
So this is a really interesting finding for how we get that gut microbiome that seems to stick with us for quite a long time. Are there any other implications for this finding?
Well, the researchers are hoping that this could provide a way to make sure that newborns, even though they have reduced immune systems, are still protected from infection. And one idea was actually giving them immune cells that they wouldn't be able to turn off that would protect them early on in life, and that maybe these cells would disappear once the baby's immune system became a lot stronger.
Finally, we have a story on virtual arms. Last year, a paralyzed person was able to move a mechanical arm with just her mind. Now, a research group is trying to top that by controlling two arms with a brain-machine interface. So, Dave, why are two arms so much better than one?
Well, try to hug a person with one arm. Try to shop at the grocery store, pull items off the shelf with one arm. It's actually a lot more complicated than it seems. And it's been an incredibly tricky problem for researchers developing so-called brain-machine interfaces, or BMIs. These are ways for paralyzed people to still be able to pick stuff up when either they don't have limbs or they don't have the use of their limbs. But using both arms is not as simple as, okay, we figured out how to get a person to use one arm, and we just add another arm to the equation. Because as you can imagine, there's this complex interplay when we move both arms. Each arm has to sort of know what the other arm is doing. They have to act in concert. And that's really incredibly complicated at a neurological level. And that's why this new study is such an advance, because what the researchers were able to do is they were able to take monkeys and train them how to use two virtual arms on a computer.
Well, let's step back for a second. How exactly does a brain-machine interface work?
Well, usually when you can't, especially if you're paralyzed and you can't move your arm, for some reason the signals from your brain are no longer getting to your arm. And so what these BMIs do is they basically take the signals from your brain directly, and then they translate those signals into the movement of either a robotic arm or, in this case, a virtual arm.
So for the monkeys, what were they moving with their minds?
They actually looked at two monkeys, and they implanted electrodes into both the left and the right side of their brains to pick up on these signals that tell limbs to move. And what the monkeys were trying to do was they had to control two virtual arms. You can actually see a picture of this actually in a video as well on the site. And their goal was to place both hands over two virtual circles and hold them there for 100 milliseconds. Now, that may not sound hard, but when you're trying to move virtual objects with your mind, it's pretty tricky. But the researchers found that over time, the monkeys were able to do this. They first trained them how to do this using joysticks, so actual joysticks. Then they took the joysticks away. They strapped the monkeys down so they couldn't use their arms, their real arms anymore. And then they wanted to see, could the monkeys learn how to use these virtual arms? And in most cases, over time, they were able to do that.
So this would actually work for a person who couldn't practice with a joystick or a keyboard. They'd just be able to watch what happened and then learn to use their mind to do the same thing.
Right. Well, one of the monkeys, she was trained first with the joysticks, but the other monkey had to do without that training because they wanted to find something that would be analogous to a person that didn't have the use of their limbs from the very beginning. You know, this monkey took longer and wasn't as successful, but eventually he was also able to control these virtual arms.
So this study not only demonstrates something amazing that we can now do with brain-machine interfaces, but it also was able to tell us something new about how the brain works. Can you talk about that?
Well, yeah, as you say, Sarah, it's not just a cool advance. It's actually teaching us a lot more about how the mind works. And it turns out that by measuring all of these signals in the brain, the researchers are also figuring out how exactly the brain coordinates the movement, even in people that aren't paralyzed in the first place. And that could really shed some light into how the brain works.
So what are the next steps for this research? We've got two arms. What's next?
Well, two legs, of course. In fact, the scientist who led this research is hoping and indeed promised on The Daily Show that by the 2014 Brazil World Cup, he will have created a robotic bodysuit that will enable a paralyzed person to kick a soccer ball. And that's only a year away.
Okay, so what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about a giant ancient platypus, the first ever evidence of insect sex. And also, speaking of the microbiome, how the bacteria in our guts may cause arthritis. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about how science is faring in the United States Senate. Also a story about why a U.S. court invalidated a patent for a Down syndrome test. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, this week's Science Live is about unraveling the mysteries of dark matter. And next week's Science Live is, speaking of neuroprosthetics, all about neuroprosthetics. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site, Science Now. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news, our upcoming live chats, and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.